My guest is here in the studio today is Dr. Gary Sinclair. So, good morning, Gary.
Good morning.
And welcome to our show.
Yeah, thanks for having me. It's my pleasure.
Yeah, it's a pleasure for us too. So, tell us about, music is all around us. So, we listen to more music now than ever before and many ways to do so. So, is there a change, Gary, in how we listen to music or how we use and the ways we respond to it?
I suppose the functions of music haven't really changed in terms of what we use it for day to day, and like they're fairly obvious in terms we use it for, for social reasons, for our own mood specific reasons. We use it kind of just to kind of manage our time when we're bored. But I suppose what my research and my colleagues' research focuses on is how that has those functions have kind of changed to a degree because of new technologies, and the amount of music that we listen to now has increased drastically, and also because of not just choice that we have and options we have for listening to music, but in terms of mobility, in terms of being able to listen to it whenever, wherever we want, because of things like the iPod initially, and then obviously because of the smartphone and music streaming like Spotify and what have you. So like the key functions are there, but it's just they're heightened, I suppose. And we're interested in that from a kind of psychological perspective, a sociological perspective as well too. And that's where a lot of our research concerns over the last few years is looking at that.
Yes. So you mean that people use music now a lot? Actually, you see them walking down with things in their ears, and you know, it's, I think people are used to it. It's technology as much as music, isn't it? So you think that technology has given kind of a license to listen to music anywhere, anytime?
Yeah, no, and like on paper, like that's fantastic. And even from a personal perspective, I love having that choice, and I love having that ability to listen to whatever I want, like whenever I want. And if you were to tell me that like 7 years ago, 8 years ago, that we would have music on tap, you would think, well, that's kind of almost like a utopia for anyone who really enjoys music. But one of the interesting things that we found from the research, and you know, a lot of it is positive, is that actually the amount of choice that people have, a very kind of first world problem, it has actually kind of created kind of psychological problems to a degree.
Yes.
In terms of it's almost like too much choice. We've like the term we use is like a paradox of too much choice. So it's almost like eating too much cake. That if you listen, if you have too much of a good thing, that it loses
the glut of it.
Yeah, it loses its emotional tension. So it loses its ability to surprise you, and it loses its kind of emotional impact because, I suppose that tension that we talk about is not there because you have too much control over it.
You mean who has the control over music?
Well, the individual. So, say for example, a lot of your listeners who get their music from the radio. If they primarily get their music from the radio, or they get it from, actually at the radio, they're leaving the choice of what they listen to up to the DJ or their listen or whatever random station that they put on. So there's a kind of opportunity to be surprised. There's an opportunity to be like, oh, remember that song, remember this. Whereas what we get, especially with kind of a lot of the younger people, we look at their music taste. In terms of what they listen to day to day, where they listen to it, and when, is very kind of planned out. Like they'll have a specific playlist for the gym, they'll have a specific playlist for commuting to work, they'll have a specific playlist for, when they're getting ready to go out. So, like, although that's good, and that's to kind of control their emotions and moods for these specific situations, the actual excitement, the kind of is removed a little bit because there's no surprise, there's no no attention in terms of that.
You mean they have it all the time?
Yeah.
And so they've lost the...
Yeah, to a degree. Some people, that's
one of the excitement of it.
Yeah, that's one of the surprising things we found were that maybe some of your listeners might relate to, say, looking at something like Netflix or something. You have so much there, but you spend half your time flicking through, like the stations are flicking through the programs to see what you want to watch. It's almost, you're crippled by the amount of choice.
That's true, really.
That you
even
have. Yeah.
As old as I am, I mean, the choices are too much, isn't it?
Yeah, to a degree.
You
know, it's when you talk about it out loud, it does really sound like moaning about
having too much.
Nothing, but like what we're interested in that is we look a lot, say, from an everyday emotional perspective. So it's very important to kind of get that proper excitement out of like engaging with art or engaging with something like sport. So if you're kind of turning it into routine, you're almost turning music into kind of wallpaper. You know, it's, we call it like an emotional wallpaper, essentially, because it's just seeping into your everyday life, and it doesn't provide that colour or provide that kind of spark that maybe people traditionally look for in music.
So what is what do you think, did in your research, did you see young people listen to music? There was a different way of listening before.
Well, yeah, I suppose you, like, there's a different technological shift like every five years. So like we'd have similar conversations about this from when the radio came on the scene to when television came on the scene to when CDs, iPods, you know, and the modern kind of streaming era. So there's always these conversations when there's these technological shifts occur, to see what the impact is, because obviously music is so important in everyday life. I suppose what changes here in terms of the impact on everyday life is not just on the actual individual, but it's actually on the data that they provide through listening to music so much to companies, to streaming apps like Spotify.
And that's to kind sell of a, them.
That's another concern. Yeah. It's kind of another way of surveilling people. So like we're probably very familiar with like the way Google and Facebook collects data on us, or Twitter or whatever the social media is. But one thing that's often forgotten is say something like Spotify and the amount of data that is actually collected on an individual every day. So if you have the average person listening to 2 or 3 hours of music a day, that gives you a massive insight into their personality, into their emotional state, because like music is like, you know, even without any of the technologies, you can tell a lot about a person by his taste in music. But not only are you able to tell about maybe their personality or their values by what they're listening to, you might be able to tap into their emotional state too, because a lot of the way music is structured on these streaming websites or streaming applications is based by mood. So they'll have specific playlists that are for, say, anger, or for you know, in a happy mood. So if you think about that as a way of like directly targeting someone from a marketing perspective, you're not just targeting them from traditional ways of, oh, I know their gender, or I know their social class, or, you know, their likely income. You actually can target people in real time based on what emotion they might be experiencing. Yes.
So like if you want to wreck the place of it, you'll have the wrecking music, is it?
Well, yeah, like I suppose like in very, very simple terms, you could describe it that way. But like there's a whole host of businesses involved in this now, in things like background music and Muzak, who would have like billions of data points where they could plug that into a system to say what the best type of music to play at any given moment is in the background of your restaurant and background of your retail shop. And like the same would then apply, say, if you're listening to Spotify and you have the free version, if you have adverts that are on in between songs, like you have all this information on this person. It's like a gold mine for marketers. It's a gold mine for any brands and products. You know, which like when we're looking at this, the more we kind of like researching it and the actual how revealing this data is, it's kind of uncomfortable. You get uncomfortable realizing that this is just another strand.
Can I just ask a question of you? There was a survey about 2 or 3 years back which was released, and it appeared to show that in this country and in the UK, and to a certain extent America, that people over the age of 33 had stopped listening to new music. Have you done any research in that area? Also, psychologically, is there any difference between physically owning something and just having something on an iPad?
Well, the first question, I have seen, we haven't done anything on it ourselves, only kind of anecdotal stuff, but what we have seen is that generally from kind of adolescence till like early 20s, regardless of technologies, just historically people, that's the music that you tend to have the most kind of emotional connection with and you are likely to stick with. So it's kind of quite hard to find new music after that, because you've kind of found your bands, you've found your genre, like, you know, 18, 19, 20, and it's hard to shift away from that. Even from personal experience, I'd find that it's very hard to find new music. But it's also, and probably it's harder now too, because there's just so much content. It's not only that people are listening to more, there literally is more content because of the internet and because of like the streaming platforms.
Is there a new music? Because they actually use old songs in new ways now, a lot of it.
I just think it's, I think there's just more because, like, if you think of traditionally with, like, television and radio, there's only a very limited kind of small few people who are the gatekeepers for what could get out there. Whereas now, which is actually a great thing if you really think about it, if you have talent and you have, like, a laptop and you have an internet connection, like, theoretically you can share that music with the world, you know? So I'm not so sure about whether it's just, like, recreating or covers and things like that. Answer to your second question was about the difference between the physical and the
kind of. Is there a psychological difference between physically owning a CD and vinyl, where you can actually physically own something, you can see the words, you can see who's produced it,
you can hold
who's
it,
mixed it, you can hold it. Especially in vinyl, because I come from an age when all we had was vinyl at one point and cassettes, and they're making a comeback too. But physically owning something, to say that you own it rather than it's just a little wav and
it's an ornament.
Yeah, we've done quite a lot of research on this and, like, looking at a lot of different age groups and even, say, you know, late teenagers and kind of young adults, they will always say, "Oh, I prefer, you know, a CD, I prefer a vinyl," and they'll cite everything that you say there about, like, even the kind of imperfections in it as well.
Absolutely.
You know? And they'll say that, but then I'll ask them, it's like, well, how do you spend your time listening to music? You know, and even people in their 30s too are like, well, yeah, I end up listening to it online most of the time, even though I actually have the record in my shelf. And one of the things that we actually noticed, and this is what some the streaming profile applications are good at doing, particularly Spotify, is to create what we kind of refer to as a kind of type of psychological ownership over, like, your profile. So they do a lot of things to kind of to make you feel that you have kind of some sort of ownership over the playlists, because you have to maybe put a bit of creativity in it, or you maybe they set up a platform for you to share it with friends, but ultimately you'll never be the same, because it's not a physical sense of ownership, and people never actually think that they own their you know, their iTunes music or their Spotify music, because it's in a cloud. It's not there in front of them. So I think people generally do have a better relationship. And you look at something like vinyl. Like, vinyl is one of the fastest growing areas of the music industry over, like, the last 10-15 years. And then people dismissed it as a kind of fad a few years ago, but it can't be if it's going that consistently, like 10-15 years, where it's like it's such a high growth market. It's because people are kind of returning to that. Maybe because it's some of the things we talked about at the start of the interview, you know.
Tell us about you know, your research is mostly on about the moods that people have, and they play music for different moods every day, how it affects everyday life.
Yeah,
our theme is about everyday life, how music.
Yeah, like, I suppose, like, some of what I've said is probably looks a bit critical of it, but, like, some of it is really interesting to see how well people manage their moods throughout the day. I suppose what we associate music and emotion, we'd associate it in a very kind of like, aesthetic way, a very, like, like extreme happiness, extreme kind of anger. But what, like, a lot of what we see is that people kind of micromanage their day. They have an interview at work, or they have kind of a tough day ahead of them, that they'll just stick on the earphones and kind of manage that mood to a degree, because they know the type of music they'll respond to, and they can find it quite quickly. And also, there's a long history of music helping mental health too, obviously, because of the ability to control and manage emotions or articulate them. But also,
there's a thing called music therapy now.
Even for physical
it's
therapy too.
Psychotherapy.
Like, there's a huge area of research on it in terms of for elderly people too, in terms of
dementia.
In particular, there's so much done on that.
Alzheimer's.
Dementia. And the reason for that is because music is so highly related to identity and to memory. So people kind of hold memories very specifically through music. It's a way of kind of managing, like, remembering who they are, essentially, and remembering those emotions they had at certain times in their life through the music. And, like, there's some great documentaries on it too. I'm sure people would
Have
seen
people
them before.
Have lost mostly they are the faculties but in mental health, but they can play music.
Look, it's not going to, like, you know, it's not
even
going to
brain damaged people.
It's not going to cure these diseases or anything like that, but it's just it's a way of managing them to a degree. And, like, we're doing a research project at the moment within the community with kind of elderly people and transition year students, like teenagers, and like none of them have like dementia or anything like that. But like they talk a lot about how they use it in their everyday life, just to kind of manage the transition, say from like retirement to, or even from school, from going from being a teenager to an adult. You know, like they don't specifically talk about this, but we can, you know, we get this from our conversations with them, and
anecdotal evidence.
Yeah, it's kind of like they kind of articulate or narrativize their life like through kind of music to a degree. They're able to kind of speak about what's going on in their life through that. So you can see, like, I think everyone probably does it to a degree, you know, to tell stories.
It's in your life, in everyday life, so much that is seeped into the language that we speak.
Yes,
language and music are connected anyway.
Yeah, that's kind of interesting. Yeah.
I was thinking, as you were saying, like in Indian music, classical music, there are the ragas, which be, they're about moods.
Yeah.
And there are ragas for morning, noon and night, and all kinds of in between.
Yeah.
And it's to evoke the listener a mood.
Yeah.
Or a sensation.
So they actually describe it that way, like this is for.
Yes, this is for. Yeah. Because they are actually improvised.
Yeah.
So the ragas are improvised.
Yeah.
And you can have even the Bollywood music is, some of the songs are from these ragas.
Yeah.
Ragas are ancient classical music. But there's devotional music in the Islamic tradition called Qawwalis. Mm. In the Sufi tradition, they sing devotional song. It is to evoke, sense of being in union with God. So I think these emotions are evoked, but they are they're not written down music.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's evoked at the moment by the player and the music, the sounds that it's
a bodily reaction to
it. Yes, the reactions.
Yeah,
yeah, and the people, the group that listen to it.
Yeah.
So and they sometimes answer back, you know. It's a little bit like gypsy music.
I don't think like the actual physical reaction we have to music has changed at all. It's just that it's just delivered through a different medium, and we get more of it, and it's more organized emotionally. And the reason it's a more organized emotionally by the content provider, i.e. like Spotify, Apple, whoever, is for marketing reasons, is for business reasons, so they can emotionally target people, you know, for whatever reasons. And like, and also, like, you know, as we've discussed here, it's that can be helpful for people too, if they like just to use it in their everyday life and to kind of manage their moods throughout the days. And like the way I'm talking now, like people don't consciously think, oh, I'm going to, you know, separate my music to have this mood and have that mood. It's more of a kind of unconscious kind of process happens. And some people are more into it than others. Like, you know, some people are a bit more maybe chaotic with how they listen to it, but it's just kind of a common theme we've seen amongst kind of certain different personality types, you know, or certain kind of types of people that maybe are more.
And you'd see this in advertisements, isn't it?
Say that again, sorry.
You'd see in advertising.
An advertising. Yeah. That's, well, like it's more kind of in terms of just another way of segmenting people into different target markets and groups. Like it's just emotionally is another way of doing it. So,
So we advertised you today by playing kind of mood music.
Yeah, exactly. Like you were targeting me with
George
that.
And I discuss this, you see.
You know, no, we were discussing earlier on Frissons, FRISSONS.
Okay.
Which is the biological technical term for a goose pimple.
Oh, really? Okay, so you learn something new every day.
Yeah.
Frissons, is that what it was?
Yes, I only learned that recently, but somebody put it up on my page on Facebook.
Okay.
If I can just ask one other question. I mean, I'm personally saturated by music. It is my be-all and end-all. But about 95% of music I listen to is in languages I don't understand.
Oh, really?
Okay. I don't care if I don't understand them. If it's musically gifted, I mean, I listen to a lot of Russian, Ukrainian music from Uzbekistan, Azerbaijan, these areas, Arabic music, Bollywood. Do you see that divide being too large a gap for people to fill? Do you think there'll ever be other George Mulcahy's out there who kind of like compromise and not understanding what the words are, but if the music is something that means something to you, you kind of compensate for that. I mean, I think in for as long as I can remember, the only two kind of big hits that weren't in English
yeah.
would have been Joe the Taxi by Vanessa Paradis
yeah.
and
yeah, yeah.
Mundi and the Baki by the Punjabi MC. But I love, again, it's the surprise element of language.
Yeah.
I don't understand it, but that doesn't matter.
Yeah.
How many people go to operas in Italian and understand every
word?
Yeah,
that's a good point. Yeah. Yeah. No, I honestly, like, I can only speculate on your question. I wouldn't say it's to do with lyrics. Like, I wouldn't say that people are alienated from Russian or Bollywood because of lyrics. I'd say it's more because of like the practical elements of promoting the music. Like, if you're kind of flogging a singer around or an artist, and most of the main kind of industry markets are English speaking, you know, so it just
exactly
you're going to push English speaking artists. I don't necessarily think it's because of the lyrics, because if you look at something like dance music at the moment, like, it's very little lyrics. Like, that's probably one of the best excelling genres of music there is.
Absolutely.
So I'm not too sure lyrics are actually overly important. So there's obviously some people who are interested in them. It depends on the type of music, obviously, like things like folk music or what have you. It's very important, but in terms of like that gap, I suppose it's available for people more and more. So say, for example, 20 years ago, if you wanted to find some new Russian music or Ukrainian music, your options were very limited.
Absolutely.
I don't know if you, I just ask you, do you find that stuff more now because you're the internet,
again,
because
it's that sense of adventure. I love listening to stuff.
Yeah, I think everybody has that. If I listen to things that I don't understand at all.
Yeah.
But the music, it's music. These notes are everywhere around the world. I mean, if we all came from, where is it? From out of Africa, we certainly have the language and the sounds of it. Yeah, you know,
absolutely.
So we are connected.
Yeah.
Music and language, it's in our brains.
Yeah, yeah.
Unfortunately, it's an awful shame that we're limited by time. Unfortunately, we could continue this discussion for several years, I think, and still only get to past the bare basics of it, but. Would you come back in again to us?
Yeah, of course. Yeah, I'd be delighted to. Yeah, yeah.
Absolutely, because as a subject matter. And again, what kind of stuff are you researching yourself?
Well, like, I am in the business school in DCU. I teach kind of and research on stuff that we call consumer behaviour, which is essentially just like the study of like human behaviour. So I suppose a lot of what we're looking at is kind of the like why people, or how the implications of people changing kind of music interest in music tastes, and we look at a variety of different things like sports and retail goods as well, but it's implications for businesses, obviously, in terms of how people spend their time, but we're probably more interested in maybe the kind of social policy implications too, if there's shifts in mental health or the shifts in say how people are using kind of everyday items and things like that.